The 1994 Salt Lake Sandstone Symposium presents session number 376, a dual paper session, Why the Church is No Longer as True as the Gospel, Administrative Centralization and the Decline of a Community by Marty Jones, and War in Heaven, War on Earth, the Militaristic Gospel of Jesus Christ by Paul Smith.
Idaho. Church was simply what we did. I remember an incident that occurred during one of our family cross-country trips, probably when I was 11 or 12. We were at a picnic stop, and my second sister and I left the rest of the family to go play. We ended up talking to another girl about our age. During the conversation, out of the blue, I asked her what ward she belonged to. It was made perfect sense to me. Later in the car, I was embarrassed when I thought about the question. How stupid could I be, assuming that everyone was Mormon? But at the time of the conversation, I was running on automatic. In retrospect, of course, the funniest thing about this incident is that the girl was, in fact, an inactive member, and she did know what ward she belonged to. But the church was the non-family part of my life, mostly because there was so much of it. Besides Sunday services and weekday primary and later MIA meetings, there were ward talent shows, there were ward auctions, there were ward bazaars, there were ward picnics, there were ward dinners, mission fund dinners, ward budget dinners, building fund dinners. There were welfare farm projects, there were canning projects, there were state plays, there were road shows, and the list goes on and on. Nearly every weekend had some type of church activity. Most of these projects, looking back, had a fundraising function. Many of these events helped contribute to the ever-raising thermometer in the chapel foyer, the thermometer with the goal of the ward budget or building fund at the top. And I remember the sense of exhilaration in the chapel when the bishop announced in sacrament meeting that the goal had been met. Now, of course, I wonder if as a child I wasn't misinterpreting a communal adult sigh of relief. More than any of the fundraising, however, I remember the associations. While we were cleaning the Sooner Stadium in Norman, Oklahoma after football games, our ward budget project, I got to work with other members of our ward, adults, teenagers, and children. We would talk as we worked. We got to know each other. Some of us became friends. I learned things about other people, often the quietest members, the ones that faded into the background on Sunday, were the hardest workers, often the ones that talked the most, that seemed to me as a child to be the most fascinating, didn't do much work at all. Ward leaders, of course, were almost always there, working along with the rest of us, blowing the trash out to the center aisle for one of us kids to put into the trash bags. And it is certain that I, as a child, had no concept of the time constraints, the balancing of priorities, the constant guilt that the leaders probably felt. As any church leader will tell you, administrative centralization has occurred because, first of all, local leaders were overwhelmed with the number of administrative chores and duties that they had been asked to perform. This is particularly true in countries other than the U.S. and Canada, where working hours were longer and left little time for lay leaders to fulfill these responsibilities. And second, because of the demands of administrative chores, most local leaders had even less time for the more crucial aspects of pastoring. When faced with these problems, church leaders attempted to minimize the administrative duties of local leaders, a laudable goal. Because of the principles of priesthood authority and correlation, however, the possible alternatives for reducing the responsibilities of bishops were limited. Decentralization simply was not an option. But the result of centralization has been, as Elder Packer has described it, a vacuum. Not merely a vacuum in programs, but a vacuum in formal organizational structures at the local level. This vacuum was created deliberately, according to Elder Packer, in order to minimize organizational demands on families, in order to allow families more time to spend together, in order to allow families more time to meet their own unassignable child-rearing responsibilities. Again, these are important positive goals. However, I would argue that in this case, the means taken to reach these goals, administrative centralization and the creation of an organizational vacuum at the local level, have contributed to the isolation and alienation of large numbers of presently and previously active members. Furthermore, the sense of isolation and alienation created at the individual level has been compounded by the loss of important counteractive tools at the level of local ward leadership. There are two parts to this argument. The first involves a discussion of the impact of the program vacuum at the individual and family level. The second involves a discussion of the importance of programs as a tool for accomplishing other goals. At the individual level, the vacuum in programs has contributed to a growing sense of isolation and alienation. This is so in part because church members are being placed in a double bind. On the one hand, no family, particularly the present nuclear unit society calls a family, has the emotional, intellectual, financial, and social resources necessary to meet the needs of all of its members all of the time. And, although doctrinally families have the ability to ask for spiritual resources, as a practical matter, increased spirituality does not solve a 9 or 10-year-old's need for friendship and companionship. In other cases, a parent's or sibling's increased spirituality may only drive another family member further out of the family network. On the other hand, as routinization and the dissolution of church programs has led more and more members to go outside their families and outside the church in search of necessary program, particularly in the social, emotional, and intellectual areas, the church has often responded by publicly and privately advising members not to participate in some of the types of groups and organizations that have developed. For example, members have been advised not to meet spiritual or intellectual needs through study groups. Members have been advised not to become involved in impact-type interpersonal personal growth or excellence training seminars, even though those groups are often successful in breaking down emotional barriers and teaching interpersonal skills. Homeschool networks have also come under attack, if only indirectly. One wonders whether computer network groups might not be next. In other words, it appears as though the church is saying, we don't want you dependent upon us to meet these needs, but neither do we want you to turning to other sources or developing other grassroots organizations to meet them either. This leaves individuals and families in an extremely alienating position. If they do not fit the normative stereotype of the perfect all-member temple-attending family, if they have needs that cannot be met in their family and are not being met at church, they have limited choices. Either meet those needs elsewhere and avoid or ignore instruction otherwise from church leaders, or choose not to meet the need, in effect denying the importance or reality of the need. It is instructive, I believe, to note that from the perspective of involvement with the church, the course of action chosen may actually be irrelevant. In either case, where there are important felt needs, the individual or family involved will inevitably feel some disharmony, some distancing, some alienation from the church itself, regardless of whether it meets the needs or denies them. At the level of local leadership, the problem of member alienation is compounded because wards have fewer organizational resources through which to involve members. We often forget that people become a part of a group horizontally. When old members move to an area or new members are baptized, they become a part of the new community sideways, so to speak, as a function of the relationships they develop, not primarily with leaders, but with other members. As we have centralized financial responsibilities and as we have correlated church programs with a view to minimizing the demands on local leaders, we have handicapped ward leaders where we have sought to help them. This is so because we have cut the space available in which to create bonds, in which to demonstrate commitment to the church. It is increasingly difficult for a new member to even get to know other ward members, let alone develop close relationships. It is increasingly difficult for a member perceived as different, whether economically, emotionally, socially, or intellectually, to demonstrate belief and commitment simply by being there, day in, day out, working, and participating. It is no longer as possible as it once was to develop relationships of equality, relationships where the bishop is simply another member of the cast of the ward play, following the instructions of the director. And without those relationships of equality, we relate to each other increasingly in terms not of the human beings we are, but in terms of the roles we happen to be playing in the Sunday services pageant. Increasingly, the formal structures of the church, outside of a limited set of leadership roles, are didactic and hierarchical. The spaces in which we discover each other are classes, where an expert, and I put that in quotes, teacher directs discussion or dispenses information, where a serious, complex question is disruptive of the expected flow and selfishly consumes limited time. We interact with each other in sacrament meetings where one member discourses to the rest. The spaces available for interaction are increasingly formal, thus lessening the opportunity for members to really share problems from their everyday lives, unless, of course, the problems have been miraculously solved and thus contribute to the faith-promoting nature of a talk or a lesson. These one-dimensional interactions contribute to the alienation felt by individual members because it is impossible in these contexts to feel known, valued, and understood unless these kinds of interactions, the hierarchical didactic, have been supplemented by other activities where people are able to interact less formally. Testimony meeting can be awfully boring unless you know the people. Somehow, a testimony of parenthood is pretty standard. Unless you know the pain and struggles of deciding whether to have children at all, given a genetically carried disorder. Unless you know the torment over to whether to get pregnant and abort, get pregnant and carry to term. Unless you know the eventual decision against ever bearing children, the decision to adopt, and the long, long wait through that process. Given a known human context, suddenly testimony meeting is a bonding, extremely emotional event. Given enough experience at the human level, in enough different words, most people will expand their tolerance for what it means to belong. A new ward, new people, becomes an exciting experience. One can hardly wait to get to know them. But where the one-dimensional interactions are not supplemented, where we go to church, and that is pretty much the extent of our interaction with other members, the fabric of group identity stretches thin. To pursue this metaphor, the interactions between members of the church I discussed earlier, the interactions of camaraderie, of working together in a common, often fundraising cause, of accomplishing something material together, whether it be a new chapel, a clean stadium, or a completed department store inventory, are the essential woof, the filling threads that connect the hierarchical threads of the warp together in a whole cloth. It is the woof that snags the newcomer, that pulls her in and binds her to the fabric, allowing her to feel and become a part of the whole. As the woof wears thin, the cloth becomes less able to build interconnections between people, increasingly fragile and subject to disintegration, at least on the edges, by a slight tug. Formal interactions and instruction are an important part of religion. Arguably, they are essential to the creation and maintenance of group identity, at least religious identity. By their very nature, however, the organization created solely or even primarily by these types of interactions is fragile, brittle, and porous. This is so because of the nature of group identity and how it is created. Group identity is never a given. Rather, it is created from complex interactions between leaders and members, members and non-members, individual and group. Group identity is in part a function of "this is what we stand for" statements and "this is what we don't stand for" statements. I am reminded of a passage from one of Orson Scott Card's science fiction novels where a tribal group is asked to make a treaty with humans. A sticking point during the negotiating process is the fact that humans insist on granting the benefits of the treaty equally to all the other tribes on the planet. The tribe with which the humans are negotiating objects vehemently because they had intended, by means of this treaty, to conquer all the other tribes and prove their own superiority over them. After some discussion, the concept becomes clear to the tribe's chief negotiator. "Oh," he says, "I see. The tribe is whatever we believe it is. If we say that the tribe is all the little ones in the forest and all the trees, then that is what the tribe is, even though some of the oldest trees here came from warriors of two different tribes, fallen in battle. We become one tribe because we say we're one tribe. You humans grow by making us a part of you. Then we are one tribe, and our greatness is your greatness, and yours is ours." Obviously, the issue is not quite that simple in human organizations, in part because we are rarely so straightforward and explicit in our determinations of identity. Group identity in human organizations is more complex because it is also a tool whereby we construct our own individual self-identities. Individual identity becomes an important aspect of group identity. How is group membership used to distinguish the individual or make the individual more similar to others in society? An all-inclusive community is of limited help to its members as they attempt to create an identity separate from non-members. This problem has become particularly acute for religious organizations, I believe, as the social space available for religious interaction has become more circumscribed in the larger society. At this point, I'd like to briefly stray from my so far more or less linear argument and explicate this last statement. Historically and anthropologically, what we might today call religious behavior, the belief in supernatural actors, the anthropomorphization of non-humans, the attribution of influence on human affairs to non-human conscious actors, has had a much broader sphere of influence than it does today. For the sake of brevity, I will limit myself to two examples from the North American continent. First of all, many Native American peoples based their interactions with nature and each other within the context of what might today be characterized as religious assumptions regarding the ultimate impact and import of their actions. Tribal governance included those basic assumptions as part and parcel of the political system. Indeed, the tribes themselves made little distinction between political and religious life. The early Puritan towns were also much less inclined to distinguish between religious and other behavior. Indeed, if Max Weber is to be believed, a crucial impetus for early capitalism was the fact that Protestants, particularly Puritans, could imbue ordinary life with salvific potential, and then by thrift and investment, prove themselves saved by virtue of their material success. But although individuals may still strive to sacralize their daily actions, all of us in Western society have succumbed to the secularization of much of our day-to-day activity. One small but more modern example of this is the shift in the LDS Church away from ecclesiastical involvement, even direction, in areas of marriage and career choices. Early members of the church submitted to and even sought such involvement. Although we all know of members who still seek answers on these questions from local leaders, the church as a whole has moved away from involvement at this level, and most members would reject such interference. It seems to me that the former actions, the involvement of bishops in such life-important decisions, presumes a predetermined sacral pattern, the violation of which might forever limit the life patterns of other individuals. The second course of action recognizes a secular fact of existence. One decision constrains all following decisions, but limits the sacral impact to the individual's own spiritual well-being. These examples demonstrate the gradual encroachment of secularity on what used to be the sphere of the sacred. Some religious groups have fought against this encroachment by refusing to modernize and by, on the basis of religious beliefs, opting out entirely of modern society. The Amish come to mind, as well as the Hasidim. This is also a technique that we Mormons used quite actively in the past. Where a group has chosen to sacralize, to make sacred or differentiate itself from other groups by opting out of what might generally be considered normal social behavior, the distinctions between insiders and outsiders can be easily made on the basis of actions. If you act as an insider, then you become an insider. If you act as an outsider, then you become an outsider. My mother informs me that she has in her possession a letter from early church authorities to my great-great-grandfather, stake president in southern Utah. In that letter, the church authorities gently point out to my grandfather that, even as a stake president, he simply does not have the authority to grant temple recommends to non-members. This letter, it seems to me, makes my point. If you acted as a member in that society, you became a member, whether or not the formalities had been observed. If a religious group, however, chooses not to opt out of modern society, then the space for sacralization, both of the organization and of the individual, becomes increasingly limited. This is, I believe, a part of the dilemma facing the church today. Where members of a religious group are not clearly set apart from modern society, group identity and individual identity, to the extent it is dependent upon the group, become increasingly limited to symbolic distinctions. The range of symbolic distinctions is broad, and covers shared experiences, ritual or otherwise, ritualized group history and stories, material symbols such as the garment or I don't know what the term is for the Jewish hat. Yarmulke, thank you. And behavioral symbols such as the word of wisdom or the Orthodox Jewish practice of separating milk from meat, as well as the symbols contained in a defined ideology. Once a religious group has chosen against opting out of normal society, it is increasingly limited to boundaries based on some combination of these symbols. As the action of members no longer easily distinguishes them from non-members, so the adherence to symbolic distinctions becomes more important. One of the most interesting sessions at the main meetings of the Mormon History Association was on the God Beyond excommunications. The similarity of the rhetoric on both sides of that conflict, those excommunications took place roughly, as I recall, 1860s, 1870s. The interesting thing of that session to me was that the rhetoric on both sides of that conflict bore an extreme similarity to the rhetoric of last September and this past spring. In all cases, both the God Beyond and the recent excommunications, the ultimate decisions appear to have been made on issues of loyalty and obedience. What I find intriguing, however, are the differences. The God Beyond conflict arose because God Beyond and his associates wished to act as Gentiles, to join in the capitalist economy. The conflicts of this past year have, I believe, centered without exception on issues of publicly espoused, but fairly abstract, beliefs. Except inasmuch as publication of those beliefs can be considered an act, the individuals involved continue to act as many, if not most, other members act. For me, at least, this comparison is demonstrative of the shifting sense of identity, and thus the boundaries of conscious toleration of differences of the LDS Church. Where the Church had opted out of normal society, group membership was defined in terms of actions, one simply acted as a member or did not. As church membership has gradually assimilated into modern society, however, the focus of group identity and the boundary markers of membership have shifted, equally gradually, from actions clearly different from those of the Gentiles to symbolic actions, word of wisdom, to ideology, and internal belief systems. Armand Moss, in his book The Angel and the Beehive, argues that these boundary changes are due first to the attempts of early 20th century church leaders to minimize the stigma of the past by assimilating into modern society, and second to the attempts of later 20th century leaders to moderate the rapid assimilation and maintain a distinct religious and group identity, at least partially in order to attract new converts. In other words, these changes might be looked upon as a form of institutional identity crisis. The economic and social pressures facing the early 20th century church almost made assimilation a requirement of survival. And even had survival been possible, and the Hasidim and the Amish have done it, the general acceptance necessary for growth was not. On the other hand, the comparatively rapid assimilation of church membership into the larger society created the need for a group identity distinguishable from that of other mainline Christian churches. I return here to my main point. Group identity is not a given. Our identities as groups and as members of groups are created iteratively, back and forth, as we collectively and individually determine the meanings of our experiences. Being Mormon is, in part, a function of my self-definition. I define myself as Mormon. Some other members agree with that self-definition or refuse to challenge it. Still others might disagree with that self-definition and call my concept of being Mormon diluted. To them, the core of essential group identity cannot tolerate someone such as myself or the beliefs that I hold. Any examination of the present range of individual definitions of what it means to be Mormon demonstrates that there is a huge diversity of those definitions. But this is identity determined at the individual level, and individuals don't, unilaterally, determine the identity of the entire group. In any organization, the individual's sense of group membership and meaning can be challenged by actions of other members. Sometimes the challenge is explicit and open. Formal sanctions are taken which explicitly invalidate an individual's definition of membership. Often, sanctions are informal. It is a simple thing in a classroom to ignore the waving hand of a disruptor, or for any comment from such an individual to be met with deafening silence. It is a simple thing to teach children that reverence, translated as sitting still and being silent, is the outward sign of godliness. It is a simple thing to recognize with leadership position in the group individuals whose definitions we agree with. It is equally easy to ignore those with whom we disagree. Children and adults who diverge from the common ground learn, slowly or quickly, as these experiences are repeated over and over, that their way of being Mormon is different, wrong, diluted. Part of the equation of group definition is an issue of power. For example, some members of the church believe that part of being Mormon means performing all priesthood ordinances in a white shirt. Whether or not an individual believes this is pretty much irrelevant. until that individual becomes the priesthood leader charged with choosing the deacons to pass the sacrament. Now, of course, the individual is in the position to teach his definition to others and to impose his definition on others, often without being aware that his definition of what it means to be Mormon is not shared by all other members. It is at this point that the trust, the acceptance, the sense of connection that develop as we work side by side in that time-consuming building project become essential. All of those experiences broaden the common ground. This is so because through these experiences, we get to know each other. Through these experiences, we share a sense of contribution. We are all together human beings working in the Lord. These experiences allow for necessary flexibility within the total community. Given the context of these experiences, it is a simple conversation, one friend to another, to say, "You know, my son doesn't wear white shirts, but he's still a good son. He's right over there. He's helping the cleanup committee. I don't think it's such a big thing whether or not my son is wearing a white shirt when he passes the sacrament." Without that context, without the cleanup committees, it is easy to perceive the conversation as a challenge to the belief, identity, and authority of the individual in power. To my mind, and I believe as I read his essay, to England's mind, the flexibility of the fabric is an important test of a school of love. Unfortunately, as the church has gone about streamlining itself, as we have attempted to free the resources of individuals and families from the demands of the church, we have also lost many of the interactions that made us flexible as a community. As a result, the fabric of the church community is increasingly unable, even at the local levels, to draw in and bind to the whole those people whom we might have known better, whom we might have trusted more, had we built a building with them.
We do not have a moderator here today, so I will just assume that role for a moment and to invite any of you to make comments or questions of Marty and on her presentation.
We have to respond.
You do?
To both papers.
To both papers. Wonderful. I didn't know that.
I'm sorry.
For those of you who are acquainted with Paul Smith, Paul Smith is a frequent attender at the symposia. And an attendant and a frequent participant as well. He cannot be here. He has asked me to read his paper, which I will do, a shortened version of which is of what he has originally prepared. And I have copies of that paper, the original paper, the lengthened version, if anyone cares to see me afterwards, and I'd be happy to provide those for you. Allow me to read his bio. It's his paper. It's his bio, certainly not mine. Then I'll introduce myself. Paul H. Smith is a career U.S. Army intelligence officer presently assigned to the Defense Intelligence Agency. In September, he will become Chief Intelligence Division for the Military District of Washington. During Desert Shield and Storm, he served with the 101st Airborne Division and has been an Arab linguist, Special Forces Intelligence Officer, Mideast Desk Officer, and an Area Analyst. He has a bachelor's degree in Middle Eastern Languages and Affairs from BYU and a master's degree in Strategic Intelligence, a Mideast concentration, from the Defense Intelligence College. Paul is currently a counselor in the bishopric of the Laurel Ward of the Columbia, Maryland stake. Included among his various church callings have been gospel doctrine, an early morning seminary teacher, blazer leader, elders quorum president, ward clerk, and assistant scoutmaster. He is also a regular participant in Sunstone Symposia. He has been in the military for 18 years and the church for 42. He is married to Darl Gibson and is the father of four. My name is Lawrence Larson. I hope a good friend of Paul and Darl. I've known them both for a number of years, and it's through that friendship that he has asked me, knowing that I would be here, to read his paper, which is entitled War in Heaven, War on Earth, the Militaristic Gospel of Jesus Christ. I think Paul's background, of course, would lend itself to this type of presentation. Not long ago, I was involved in a discussion with an individual, I shall call him John, who was taking the church to task for injustices he thought certain of its leaders had committed. Trying to be helpful, I suggested he rethink the in-your-face approach he had adopted. I suggested he first try to look at things from the church leadership's point of view. He could then adapt his methods for the greatest chance of success while causing the least amount of hard feelings. I explained that as a career intelligence officer, I had been counseled over and over to know the enemy, to understand not only an opponent's resources and capabilities, but how he thought and made decisions, and how his understanding of facts and events differed from my own. One could then better predict what an opponent might do and could better plan how best to deal with likely eventualities. Church leaders, I counseled, see themselves as generals of a valiant army engaged in a life-or-death struggle with the powers of darkness. As such, they perceive it their duty to see to the discipline, drilling, and protection of the soldiers, that is, the Latter-day Saints, under their care. As in any military organization, using the wrong tactic to approach, or in John's case, reproach, the church hierarchy would be interpreted as disloyalty, sedition, even mutiny, with predictable consequences. John disliked my analogy. He protested vigorously that the Church of Jesus Christ is not a military organization and they had no business acting as if it were. Christ's gospel is one of peace, of amicability and tolerance. Therefore, the LDS Church's formula for order and discipline is a tool of intolerance, which suppresses diversity and supports the struggle to retain patriarchal power. Unfortunately, John was wrong about the military elements inherent in the gospel and Church of Jesus Christ. He persevered in his chosen approach, failed to accomplish his desired result, and suffered personally for it as well. It is obvious why John misunderstood. Though he comes from an LDS background, he admits some admiration for progressive Protestant theology. And many mainstream Protestant Christians today believe that the gospel as preached by Christ is pacifistic, decentralized, and non-authoritarian. Hierarchical organization power, other than in a symbolically spiritual sense, or military imagery, is judged foreign to the gospel of peace. Peace being understood as the lack of conflict, rather than in its true Christian meaning of inner harmony with God and self. To reach these conclusions, however, requires one to ignore or rationalize major portions of canonized scripture. Because of our expanded scripture base and well-documented modern history, Mormons would have even more to reject. Ultimately, those who think that militarism is foreign to church and gospel understand the essence of neither gospel nor military. Most important, they also fail to realize that there really is a war going on. Modern perceptions about the nonviolence of Christ's gospel spring from a number of widely cited scriptures. We are told to love our neighbors as ourselves, to love one another as I have loved you, and to turn the other cheek. Christ warns us, who lives by the sword, dies by the sword. In the millennium, we will learn war no more. Our swords will be beaten into plowshares. We know Christ as the Prince of Peace. But in our reasonable desire to publish peace, we overlook another dialectic in the gospel. Christ methodically braiding a whip, then using it to drive the moneylenders from the temple. Passages using martial imagery such as, the word of God is sharper than a two-edged sword. And, I am not come to bring peace, but the sword. We forget the violent, harrowing, winding-up scenes in Revelation over which Christ directly presides. And what of Ananias and Sapphira, abruptly struck dead by God for having lied to the apostles about their participation in the United Order of the day? War in heaven, Nephi's decapitation of Laban, the promise of wholesale destruction of the unrighteous at Christ's return. In reality, the gospel is neither violent and militaristic, nor meek and pacifistic. Rather, it is a paradoxical balance, a tension between force and submission, between war and peace, judgment and mercy. The gospel is a fusion of opposites. Each, untempered by the other, would be unmercifully destructive or irredeemably impotent. Yet, in unity, they achieve harmonious balance. There are those who will reject the notion that any sort of violence or compulsion might be connected with the gospel of Jesus Christ. After all, was it not Satan's plan to compel us to attain salvation? Yet even God has used force when expedient. Adam and Eve driven from the garden. The people of Noah's time rubbed out. The priests of Baal perished in flames. Like most parents, God knows that with some children there are times when only severity will do. At his coming, Christ has promised he will burn the wicked as stubble. And Satan will not happily go off to outer darkness at the drop of a polite request. Someone will have to drag him there, kicking and screaming. Strip away all the niceties, and we are struck by how closely the church resembles an army. This will doubtlessly unsettle some, since those exposed only to Sylvester Stallone movies and reports of $500 wrenches have overly negative images of the military. But to better understand the church/military relationship, it is useful to know more about the military. Most of us think first of the military's capacity to destroy. But how is that destructive capacity created? Weapons come to mind. But weapons are only secondary. In the first three Arab-Israeli wars, Israel, using obsolescent weapons, handily defeated much larger, state-of-the-art equipped forces. All other factors being equal, a well-led, organized, and disciplined army will inevitably defeat a much larger, but more poorly led and organized foe. Simply described, then, the first priority of a military organization is to take a mob of individuals having so little in common with each other that, left to their own devices, they couldn't get together on a breakfast menu, much less cooperate en masse in prosecuting a battle, and weld them into a coherent group. Organizing and directing large forces requires discipline and structure. Rugged individualism is a mythic American quality which has its value in a frontier environment and is a vital catalyst in fomenting positive economic, social, and scientific change. But Rambo notwithstanding, too much individualism is literally the kiss of death in combat. Early LDS leaders realized this, which is why the beehive became our symbol, not the mountain man. Our hymns remind us of military parallels in the LDS Church. Behold a royal army, and hope of Israel, Zion's army. We watch and work and fight and pray. With our shoulder to the wheel, since we are all enlisted till the conflict is o'er. In the fight for right we will wield a sword, the mighty sword of truth, while we enthusiastically sing Luther's great hymn that assures us our God is a mighty fortress. Our general authorities tell us to follow our file leaders. We are cautioned in one recent infamous address not to lose our bearings and leave that segment of the line to which we are assigned unprotected, conjuring up images of Marines defending the perimeter on Guadalcanal. Organizationally, the church's hierarchical structure closely parallels that of the military. At each level is a commander/president and his staff/counselors. Like the military, span of control within the church is assured by tiering of the leadership. The church president and apostles, direct area presidents, who pass policy on to regional representatives, who chastise stake presidents, set goals for bishops. And like the military, the church is as organized at lower echelons as it is at higher levels. Priesthood quorums, auxiliaries, committees, classes, specialists, coordinators, built-in redundancy, designated chain of command and authorities, and standard operating procedures to determine how, when, and by whom actions will be executed and resources expended or requisitioned. Yet, despite clear military similarities, there is a second dialectic in the church which works to buffer the first. Renounce war, proclaim peace, Joseph Smith declared in the early days of Missouri Troubles. As oft as thine enemy repenteth of the trespass wherewith he has trespassed against thee, thou shalt forgive him until 70 times 7. In his essay, Conscientious Objectors or Christian Soldiers, Michael Quinn details the continued ambivalence of the church in working toward a synthesis of militarism and conscientious objection. A significant difference between the secular military and the church is that a national army is trained, armed, and equipped for physical conflict with well-defined enemies. The church is prepared for spiritual conflict with forces of an entirely different nature. Nonetheless, the military undercurrent within the church indeed exists. The question remains, why? We know the answer, but many of us have lost sight of it. The fact is, there really is a war going on. The plan of salvation itself was initiated in desperate battle, Michael leading the hosts of heaven against Lucifer and his minions. And the battle rages on, only the setting has changed. I have heard that a frog tossed into a vat of boiling water will immediately leap out, but if placed in a pan of cold water and gradually heated, he will cook unawares. Often it is so with us. We are part of a society and move through time with it. Levels of excess and abuse develop incrementally, often impacting only gradually on our limited spans of perception. At times, we may be surprised, disturbed, scandalized, even angered by what we hear or see, but we eventually become habituated and cease to be aware of it. Violence, depravity, licentiousness, so often reported in the newspapers, so regularly blared forth from the television, begin to fade from our attention, no matter how high the volume. Yet, if we could suddenly contrast our day with 50 years ago, or even 20, we might be shocked at how society and we have changed. Consider the present state of the kingdom. Divorce, even among temple marriages, has increased dramatically in recent decades. Marital infidelity has swelled into a chronic, nagging problem. Child and spouse abuse have become issues with which the church must increasingly grapple. Even as the ranks of church members swell on foreign missions, activity levels in the core shrink. The saints become disaffected, lazy, enticed away by the wiles of the secular culture in which we all swim. Members pick and choose among callings. Temple attendance wanes. Dissatisfaction with policies and leaders, and even long-revered doctrines, escalates. Families are fragmenting, not only in society at large, but increasingly in the church as well. More and more, Latter-day Saint youth buy into the prevailing culture and are sucked away, all too often permanently lost to the church. Parents go into ecclesiastical retirement, choosing recreation, career, or rationalized self-actualization over church service. Even as new members come into our midst, we hemorrhage numbers of older ones. The church is targeted by ever more sophisticated anti-Mormon assaults and more frequently singled out for actual physical attack by Latin American guerrillas. Within the church itself, zealous last-day cults and tiny fanatical fundamentalist groups ally themselves with white supremacists. And ironically, as diversity becomes more broadly accepted within society, the norms and behavior the church expects of its members are increasingly viewed by the external culture as alien. Listening to Nirvana or Jane's Addiction and wearing a safety pin through your cheek are aberrations to be tolerated. But not dating until you are 16 instead of having sex when you're 12 is considered odd or even bad form. In our own wards, we see occasional signs of church members succumbing to the sirens of worldliness. A kid on drugs, a new member refusing to attend church after viewing the Godmakers his mother-in-law sent him, an acrimonious divorce, a single sister moving in with a boyfriend, a baby born out of wedlock. May it magnify this by more than 20,000 wards, 2,000 stakes. Trends not evident at the local level become glaringly obvious at church headquarters. It boils down to a matter of belief. The church authorities and most of its members believe that the institution itself, as well as each member individually, is literally under attack. Each of us must decide for ourselves what we believe. Assuming the war is real, the need for the church's formal structure and attempts at discipline becomes apparent. Without them, the distinctive identity of Latter-day Saints may begin to blur, then be swept away. Heterodox doctrines could mushroom. Central authority could disappear. Schisms could proliferate and, like an infantry division disrupted by an enemy's violent attack, the church could fragment as did Christ's original church. Many members could succumb to secular culture or be assimilated into other denominations. Though this sounds extreme, it follows a pattern often repeated in history. Frankly speaking, it could happen here. Whether one believes that Christ intended his church to be formally structured or merely a fraternal association of believers depends much on the tradition one accepts and how one interprets the scriptures. The LDS Church has believed from its inception that a specific structure and organization are integral to the Church of Jesus Christ throughout its earthly existence, and that the self and institutional discipline produced is essential in effectively resisting the world and winning the war of testimony. Whether a member agrees with this line of thinking or not can determine whether he or she accepts the rigors of church life and obedience to commandments, or chafes at rules, bridles at perceived slights, or openly rebels at the instances of serious and very real abuse of authority in which any human leader, called by God or not, may sometimes engage. For organizations like the military or the church to successfully accomplish their missions, it is essential that the members adhere to duty and fulfill their assignments. Failure to do so may threaten not only the mission, but the survival of fellow members or even the organization itself. In the military, those who fail to act in the best interest of the organization can be demoted, imprisoned, even executed. Of course, such draconian measures are neither appropriate nor possible in the church. Yet there is a danger that if enough members were to keep their own counsel as to appropriate behavior or what degree of obedience to render, which doctrines to accept, which to reject, which leaders to follow, which to ignore, and if, as many of the loyal opposition currently advocate, the institutional church were to decide to tolerate a much greater range of heterodox beliefs and practices, the very structure that bequeaths the church's survivability in the face of enemies could disintegrate. The church's mission could fail. The church could founder. Understanding that there are some things we are free to do or believe or speak, whether rightly or wrongly, but which if promoted publicly will inevitably make us enemies of the church, is probably the most important message to take away from this discussion. I'm speaking here not of issues that someone in a leadership position mistakenly sees as threats, but rather of issues or ideas that truly are dangerous to the church. There are those among the LDS intelligentsia who seem unable to tell the difference. This is perhaps the place for me to make a disclaimer. I'm an unlikely person to seek a career in the military, a fact noted more than once over the years by my peers. I'm only accidentally a careerist, since each time I contemplated leaving, I was offered just one more interesting or exciting assignment. My hair is often just a little too long, my shoes a little too scuffed to fit the grooming standard soldier. At the office, my hugely cluttered desk symbolizes my rebellion against sterile tidiness. Two statements, one by H.L. Mencken, another by Ambrose Bierce, both of which I wield often in bureaucratic settings, summarize my personal philosophy. The first, foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. And the second, to plan is to bother about the best means of accomplishing an accidental result. So despite the positive things I have said about order, discipline, the military, and hierarchy, I have at one time or another been disdainful of each and all of them, and expect to be disdainful again as occasion warrants. But after nearly 20 years of exposure to these things, I must grudgingly admit their value in the right circumstances and proper settings. I have learned why discipline, organization, and order in the proper context are necessary. I have experienced the pride and sense of corporate connectedness in a disciplined and single-minded group. I have seen the sheer power and direction available to a structured organization where everyone knows his or her job and place and is caught up in the spirit and driving force of the whole. Just over 3 years ago, I participated as a very small cog in a large machine that moved 3,000 combat-loaded troops and three artillery batteries 90 miles deep into hostile Iraqi territory in 2 hours using 400 aircraft. This operation was perfectly executed without accident while engaging and capturing two enemy battalion-sized defensive positions. I know that such an undertaking would not have been possible without the kind of organization, command structure, and discipline achieved through military principles. The magnitude of that operation pales when compared to the church's mission. It is to preach the gospel to the world, which translates currently into 46,000 missionaries, 295 missions, and nearly as many languages. It is to perfect the saints, which means in concrete terms the acquisition and management of a huge infrastructure, thousands of chapels, temples, canneries, educational and communications resources, personnel, storehouses, farms, etc. But more important, it means trying to monitor the spiritual and temporal well-being of nearly 9 million members in 146 countries worldwide, identifying problems, creating programs and solutions that will prove effective even after having been diluted and distorted by passage down the chains of responsibility to the massive members at the bottom. It means keeping in mind the so-called butterfly effect, that a small misunderstanding, a wrongly used word at the top, can become grossly distorted by the time it has reached wide distribution. It means being prepared for the frustration of having counsel ignored by many of even the most active among the membership. It means repeating messages time after time until they have an impact, at the risk of the saints becoming totally habituated and oblivious to them. And finally, the church's mission is to redeem the dead, which means building dozens, eventually even hundreds of temples, identifying and performing ordinances for literally billions of people. It is hard to contemplate how, without a regimented structure, a clearly defined chain of command, and the ready willingness of obedient members, it would be impossible to begin such a mission, much less hope to accomplish it. In the course of this paper, I have pointed out what I see as the benefits of military-style elements in the church, but I recognize the dangers as well. Even though the organizational principles I've discussed are timeless and universal, they are, like scientific laws, amoral. Properly applied, they can develop considerable power. But whether that power is used for good or for ill depends on how the people in control wield it. Leaders are human. They make mistakes. Mistakes made when one is in a position of authority are magnified many times over and can do irreparable harm. A leader must be willing and humble enough to acknowledge mistakes. Hiding errors in judgment is always a bad idea. The error will inevitably out, doubling the damage. By covering up Paul Dunn's tall tales and then shooting the messenger through reprisals against the person reporting, the hierarchy of the church cast itself as accessory to the lies, a clearly unfortunate position for servants of the Lord. Leaders must also be careful not to be too secretive. A wise commander knows that his troops respond better when they are as informed as possible about what is happening and why they are asked to do the tasks assigned them. This allows for wiser choices and improves the quality and effectiveness of individual initiative. But most of all, it heightens trust. If soldiers know that their leaders will be open and forthcoming with as much information as security permits, they will trust far more readily that information withheld is properly secret. The deception surrounding President Benson's competency is a prime example of damage caused by undue secrecy. Nothing positive was gained by perpetuating the subterfuge that the prophet was frail but still functional. I seriously doubt that members' testimonies would have suffered had they been told that the prophet was incapacitated. Procedures are in place to provide leadership in the event of the president's death or disability. By perpetuating the ruse, the church set itself up for embarrassment, creating the very conditions under which the Steve Benson incident could occur. It really comes back to trust. Leaders must trust church members to do their duty. members must trust leaders to have the purest of motives, to exercise the fairness of judgment, and to open themselves most diligently to the inspiration of God. That leader who becomes arrogant, who is caught up in the pride of position, who is enamored by the power he wields, who is flattered by the deference shown him by underlings and the mass of members, will ultimately make bad decisions, or will make the right decisions from the wrong motives, with ultimate bad results. He will erode the confidence and trust placed in him and his fellow leaders by the members who are the church. No leader, whether prophet, apostle, stake president, or bishop, is immune. In fact, the more removed one is from normal daily interactions with the rank and file, the greater the danger. Both the scriptures and church history tell of priesthood authorities who yielded to the seductions of power and position. Just as every member should regularly engage in sincere self-examination, evaluating where one stands in one's eternal progression, so too should every leader continually question his actions and attitudes, assessing whether he is being guided by true revelation or by his own desires, biases, and counsel. Church leaders are accountable downward to the members they serve, not just upwards to Jesus Christ. They must not forget that the rank and file of the church are more than units, resources, and combat power. They are real people with real feelings and faces. There is no excuse for cavalier treatment of members whose concerns are truly sincere, even if the leader feels that their concerns are misplaced. This does not preclude tough measures that must sometimes be taken against the few to protect the majority. But discipline harshly and arbitrarily applied destroys trust among the members. Morale is undermined and the organization is weakened. Christ must sooner or later hold accountable those in authority who err in judgment through bias, ignorance, or pride. Fortunately, and contrary to what some critics wish to believe, most authorities, whether local or general, execute their duties righteously and fairly, with true charity and concern for the members. Given the size and complexity of the church and the intensity of many of its problems, I believe our leaders do amazingly well, certainly far, far better than any secular organization of which I am aware. Nevertheless, their occasional lapses can be disturbing to faithful members and provide grist for the mills of detractors. As I conclude my thoughts, I think back to my conversation with John, in which I told him that if he really wanted to be successful in his appeal to the leaders of the church, he needed to understand how general authorities look at things and adjust his strategy accordingly. Having had the advantage of more time and thought, I would expand on that. To successfully accomplish our missions as individual Latter-day Saints and as a corporate church, while the war between good and evil still rages, we all have to try to understand each other. To adjust and adapt to the best possible fit for all under the circumstances, we need to recognize things are ours to do, whether pleasant or not, and do them. Then perhaps we will be ready in victory to sing and shout with the armies of heaven, "Hosanna, Hosanna, to God and the Lamb."
My name is Murray Lowe, and I was asked by Marty to comment on the papers, and I'd hoped to meet Paul today, and he's not here, but I did receive a copy of his paper beforehand and had a chance to read it. By way of background, I have a master's degree in organizational behavior, and I'm a management consultant. One of my college professors who just finished speaking here at the symposium used to always tell us that when you heard somebody speak, you would learn more about that person than the subject they were speaking about. And as I read these two different approaches about talking to the church, it came to mind, and I think today you'll probably have learned more about Marty Jones and about Paul Smith and Murray Lowe than you probably will have learned about anything else of substance. And what he meant is that people are so influenced by their biases that it's impossible to be removed from them. I guess one of the biases that you need to know is that 5 or 10 years ago, I had a goal to get to the top of corporate America, and that's changed. Now I have a goal to change corporate America, get a different thing than it is now. And so I'm a student of organizations. The more I study them, the less I know. And in fact, I work with other people, and the more and more we learn about organizations, the less we really understand them. And so I'm not sure that I have anything really to add, except to say that I think we're talking here mainly about the organization of the church as opposed to the gospel and the doctrine. And so hopefully I will have something to say that will push your thinking, and really, rather than comment on the papers, I think I just want to talk about the issues that they raised for me. Before I do that, I want to kind of summarize the two papers, because that would serve as a context for my remarks, and then they'll be fairly brief. What I thought Marty said, and of course she'll get really mad at me afterwards for saying this, I think she said that the church is becoming more of a doctrinally based organization and less of a holistic community, and that there's been an administrative centralization and a loss of local activity, which has kind of caused that shift to happen. And it's also resulted in a loss of community that's necessary to bind people together. There needs to be a community of love or warp, as Marty described it, the horizontal warp as well as the vertical warp needed, so that the doctrinal ideals can be shared in a way that is productive for the whole community. As I read what Paul Smith said, and I'd be glad to talk to Paul sometime if I get that opportunity, he implies that I think that the church resembles a military organization because, one, there really is a war, and two, the structures and policies that are found in military organizations need to exist in the church to complete the very important and monumental task to win that war. And then I think Paul also has some caveats to leaders and the members alike about how they exist and the type of attitude they have towards each other in that organization. Now, one of the implications of that argument that I take away is that many of the problems facing the church today result from individual rather than structural or procedural forces. And I think Eugene England's original essay tried to address that. He tried to say, people used to say, well, the gospel's true, but the church is made of individuals who, you know, are imperfect. And I think what Dr. England was saying was that the church can also be true. And I think that's kind of the same message I heard in Paul Smith's. The church is true, but the individuals who run them need to have more trust, and et cetera. Now, again, the dilemmas that I see facing the church today, I think, are related to these ideas. And instead of talking about the church directly, I'd like to talk a little bit about what I do and the organizations I work with. I work with very large companies. Most of them are large multinational corporations. They're bureaucratic. They employ hundreds of thousands of people. Information is not shared. Loyalty is encouraged. If people are disloyal to these organizations, they're often kicked out of the organization. There's so much bureaucracy. There's so many policies and procedures and structural things that happen in these big companies that pretty soon the organization can't do what they want to do. People start thinking of their own group as what the organization's all about, and they forget the organization's broader goals. And only the people at the top, they're very hierarchical, and decisions kind of flow up and down, and because decisions flow up and down, the organization can't do anything. People want to make a change, it has to go all the way up to the top and then call all the way back down again, and then by that time they've lost the energy to do it. By way of an aside, a lot of scholars in my field have said that the problems of these organizations could relate to the fact that some of the metaphors that culturally describe them, and one of the metaphors that gets attacked, at least by scholars in my field, is kind of the military metaphor, which says that companies that have these military metaphors about winning wars and competing battles for market share and strategic plans, and there's an enemy out there, and you need loyalty and discipline. And some of those things are good, but taken to the extreme, they really have caused a lot of the problems of the large organizations I work with. And so to kind of relate the church to a military organization, to me, simply says that the church is like a lot of companies I work with. And it resembles large business organizations today. That's what it says to me. Now, that's kind of the bad current state. There's another ideal state, which people describe as an organization that's lean and nimble and flexible, and everyone in the organization is committed to it, and people have a lot of energy for it, and they can make decisions. They work across functions. They work in teams. Everyone's part of what's happening. They want to make it work, and it's just a real exciting place. And this is the organization of the 90s, and I read all about it, and I want to see that. The problem I face in my work is that I'm working with these, and I know what the ideal is, and I have to get them from A to B. And the distance between those two is huge. And actually, that's kind of the what kind of started the re-engineering effort. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but it's kind of the business buzzword these days is re-engineering. And the reason that is because we have these large dysfunctional organizations that don't work. And we re-engineering says, let's start over. Let's start with a blank sheet of paper. Now, the point of the analogy, I guess, for me is to kind of draw back and look at the church. And in some respects, I see the church as an organization that needs to be over here and maybe is over here. And there's a gap there. And I think some of the gap is attributable to size. It's attributable to some of the things Marty has said. However, I also want to point out that for me, I don't see that the church is like all businesses I work with. For example, I see a lot more commitment, a lot more energy towards the organization's goals in the church than I do in the companies I work for. And my current experience in the church, I see, for example, a lot of community, and I see a lot of good. I see a lot of people who are spending a lot of time with their family. They are reading the scriptures together as a family and having family home meetings. I see a lot of positive energy within the church at least at my level, and families who are really trying to live the gospel and who are very strong. They have a unity of faith and purpose and love, and it's important to me because of my background in the church. My father was a bishop in the 60s, and before he had been a bishop, he had something like 4 or 5 or 6 church callings, and when he got called to be a bishop, it was like it was a relief for him. This was like scaling down the size of his church workload. My oldest brother grew up with then, was a teenager then, and he and many of his friends rebelled against the church. And there were a lot of forces that certainly went into that. But even today, he really resents the fact that the church kind of stole his father. He never had a father, and he really felt that, boy, Well, and in some respects, when I was a young child, I don't remember my father either. I don't ever recall him putting me to bed or reading me stories or being interested in my schoolwork, except on a very broad level. I see members of the church today, at least the people I work with, being much more involved in their families' lives. And so I think the church said, gee, we have a real problem here. We're taking too much time away from people. Let's centralize. Organizationally, let's take some of the burden off of them so that they could have more time with their families. And I really see that happening today, and I think there will be positive impacts on families. However, again, and this relates to what I do in my work, when you make a change, you go into a company and you make a change, you think, you make change A and you think B is going to happen. And sometimes it actually works that way. Usually B happens, but also C, D, E, and F happens too. And so there's been some unintended consequences, I think, of some of the administrative centralization, which Marty has pointed out very, very clearly in her paper. So there's kind of a gap in community, I think, that needs to be filled. Fortunately, I live in a community, in a ward, in an area where that gap has been filled naturally. For example, my wife belongs to a number of associations that are not sponsored by the church, a book group, a mother's group, an exercise group, an eating out group, and these groups aren't exclusive to people who live in our ward or our community. They're very broad, And that sense of community is very important for me. I travel a lot, and it provides my wife and my family a real support network. Now, the church does help out. We have a parade for the 24th of July, and we have campouts and things. But we have a lot of informal things, too. We have what we call the cul-de-sac of fire. On July 4th, everyone in the ward gets together, and it's not the ward, it's the community, gets together in a cul-de-sac, and we light off fireworks and sing patriotic songs. And another example, I think, is my next-door neighbor wanted to do a Fathers and Sons camp out. The church didn't want to do it, so he just organized it, invited everyone in the neighborhood, and we had a great camp out. And so I think there need, because the church has taken away some of these fundraising projects and some of the administrative burden off of leaders, that something needs to happen to fill that gap. And my hope is that members of the church, because they have more time with their families, will fill that void. I don't know what else to say about... I've got a lot of other things to say. I'd kind of like to open this to some conversation here. Let me just say a couple of things. From my perspective, when I work with companies and we go in and we work with their problems, we come up with a different ways they can structure themselves and different ways that they can organize themselves. And from my perspective, there could be a number of different ways that the church could choose to restructure itself that is within the existing gospel, within the scripture, and within what I think is a very solid foundation, which is the basic threefold mission of the church. There could be tremendous decentralization. There could be different ways of organizing ecclesiastical boundaries, different callings, different options. And I think the first thing that I do in a company is to go in and make sure the organization understands its purpose, what it's all about. And I think our church has a very solid understanding of that. And I believe that... in fact, the church today does explore some of those options. I don't think they talk about it publicly, but I believe that at certain levels there is talk about restructuring the church, and that it will happen because there are some gaps in the organization, and there are real problems with the kind of the top-down, command and control type organization that eventually gets in the way of anything getting done. I guess that's probably what I need to stop saying. That's a good place to stop. Say there's lots of potential for changes and for structural changes to take care of some of the dilemmas. The church is so big now. It wasn't in the 50s and 40s. The church was the community, and it's not anymore. I do really have hope for the church as it moves forward. Again, I think the threefold mission really is a foundation that is tremendous when you think about the organization. I guess the second reason I have a lot of hope is because of all the people here and the people at this symposium. They are trying to change the church, and I endorse their efforts, and while I'm not leading the forefront, I think there are many ways that people can get involved. Also, I see many people who are committed to the principles of the gospel and the success of the organization. That's, you know, I go into companies and a lot of times people are ready to bail out the whole organization. I see that there are some in the church, but for the most part, many people are very committed. And I guess my final reason is that I believe that we have a Savior who loves us all and understands what we're doing and our struggles, and He'll help us take us along the paths we need to undertake here in this mortal existence. Thank you. Now, I guess it's time to open up for discussion. Is that the way it works? I'm going to moderate the discussion. Questions for anyone here?
I am really uncomfortable with war.
Mm-hmm.
And, when he was talking about knowing your enemy.
Know thyself instead of know the enemy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
you're assuming I'm thinking up here. do you want me to repeat that? Okay. Oh, you didn't tell me that beforehand. Do you want to come repeat it? I'll repeat it. Well, I guess the comment was is that there's a brother who is very concerned about the fact that we need to know the enemy. And in South America, the missionaries many years ago were counseled, rather than knowing the enemy, to put the enemy behind them and to just move forward and forget about the enemy and worry about the job they had to do. Is that captured? Okay. Other comments?
I have some questions, but I also have a response to him.
Come on up. I'm ready to stop moderating any minute now. I'll jump back up.
Just yesterday, I visited the session on sexual abuse, and there's a lot of people there, or
indication there that they just can't put something behind them. They've got to work through some things, okay? This concept of putting something behind you doesn't work, okay? But anyway, my question to Marty, you had the argument that if I understood you correctly, the excommunications of the September 93 had to do with loyalty to brother and all this stuff, and that didn't follow tradition. Am I correct in what you said? Then I have no argument.
Let me clarify. I may have got over that part of my part, what I was saying a little bit too fast. I think that in how the issues were couched between the God-Beit excommunications and the September 93, both the God-Beits and the 93 were couched in terms of loyalty, were couched in terms of obedience. And the session at MHA this spring made that very clear. The rhetoric from Brigham Young and the rhetoric from John Godby could have just as easily been put in the mouths of Paul Toscano and Boyd K. Packer. I mean, it's the same rhetoric. But beneath the rhetoric, there was a very important distinction between what was going on with the God-Beits and what was going on in September 96, because the God-Beits wanted to act like Gentiles. They wanted to join the capitalist economy, whereas, to the best of what I can see, the September 93 group weren't particularly arguing that they wanted to act like Gentiles. They just wanted to think different thoughts from what the hierarchy or from what the rest of the church membership felt was appropriate for membership.
Okay. No questions then. I do have a question for you. Forgotten your name, but how did I forget that name? You talked about the church leaders needing to be more accountable downward, and my question is, are they accountable to Jesus Christ? And if they are, how are they, or is that a myth? How are they accountable to Jesus?
No comment.
They are accountable to Jesus Christ in the same way that we all are. And to the extent that we have callings in the church and we endeavor to fulfill those callings in the best way we can, we are accountable not only to our leaders and our wards or stakes, but also to the Savior. They are accountable in the same fashion, I believe. Now, how to articulate that in specific measure, I can't tell you, except that all of us, I think, will be held accountable if we don't pursue those callings that we have with diligence, desire, and fulfillment to the level that we're able. I wanted to respond to this gentleman. I despise war. I regard the military as a necessity for the general welfare and the peace of our society. I decry war. And Sister Larson and I sit there, and sometimes I make up words as I'm singing hymns that make no sense at all when we get to the war imagery in the hymns. But to say that we just put things behind us, that Paul's point is that we need to know the enemy. And I think he gave a good illustration of why it's necessary, is that we are bombarded with so many things. In our community of Las Vegas, we see a lot of things that you don't see here in the state of Utah. And yet we need to recognize those as the enemy and to warn our kids and our adults at all times that these are the forces of evil. They're at war against us. They would capture us. And to just say to put them behind us, I think, would be too simplistic.
Let me answer both of you. I agree that you really have to work through this.
Can you come up to the mic?
The taping's probably over with.
I do agree that this is something that you have to work through. And in my work as an emergency physician, I see a lot of abuse. And it is damaging. I did not have the opportunity of being at the meeting yesterday, but I listened to it on the radio. And I appreciate the damaging effect that this has on souls, young souls, that are not well-formed, or egos that are in the developmental stage. And surely if Christ had any condemnation for anybody, it was for those people that abused the little ones. That was the only time he ever said the death penalty. It's better for this person that a millstone be put around his neck and he be drowned. But the mark of healing in abuse and in anything else is the ability to forgive the perpetrator. And we have to look at that as the end result, as the end goal.
I think we're going to have to end it here. I guess, is that correct? It's. Do you have one more comment? Okay. I guess people can stay around and talk afterwards if we need to.